Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Green Tea, an energy podcast brought to you by the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. My name is Amethyst Devlin, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts,
Shada Hushmandi,
Abigail Hunter,
Leonie Hikita.
In our first episode, we began to dig into international climate governance. This is a huge topic, and honestly, we had 1 million questions for Jesse. When we began to edit this episode, we just could not bring ourselves to cut much out, so we decided to make this a two-part series. In this second segment, we dig deeper into the details of the role that this governance structure plays in combating climate change, both here in the U.S. and internationally. Most importantly, we asked Jesse to help us uncover what the key aspects are and to ensure that these frameworks, such as the Paris Agreement, succeed.
Particularly curious to hear what kind of a looming potential recession could mean for some countries, like, or just inflationary impacts that we're already experiencing that have an outsized effect on developing countries or lower income countries. Is that decreasing the pool of money that countries can spend on climate mitigation and adaptation? What are kind of the effects now and into the future on that you might see?
There are increasing pressures on development and foreign assistance budgets around the world, whether it's interest rate risk, it's inflation risk, it's just pressures from elsewhere on the budget in terms of the amount of money we are providing to help Ukraine fight and win the war. There's always, you know, the problem with climate, having done this for a long time, is there's always something that's more important, right? Mm-hmm. There's always something that's in the headlines, there's always something that's more politically salient. So you have to be able to balance those running crises that develop and you cannot anticipate with the need to keep a constant baseline of climate assistance. But yes, none of this makes it easier. The war in Ukraine does not make it easier.
Right.
Rising inflation does not make it easier. It also makes, I think, publics, generally speaking, a little less enthusiastic about providing foreign assistance, even though it's a vanishing fraction of the total amount of money the government spends. People just feel like we should be fixing problems here at home. We have economic issues we should be addressing. And that is a tough sentiment politically sometimes to challenge.
Going back to your point about the fact that sort of developed countries will show the way to the developing countries how to avoid some of the mistakes that they've made, but how can you actually show sub-Saharan Africa and tell them leapfrog some of the things that we've experienced, and you know, while they have like near zero or even zero accessibility to electricity, and they certainly need natural gas to have more access to electricity, to have, you know, more prosperity, more economic development and growth. How would you analyze that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, the central lesson here is that every country is different. We sort of try to avoid talking about continents as facing a challenge or specific regions, because even within a country like the United States, you have very wealthy people, you have very poor people, you have rich regions that are going to be able to adapt and cope with climate challenges, you have regions that will struggle profoundly. And so, you know, we are always trying to get away from the framework in the climate international climate negotiations that it's north versus south, developed versus developing. There are poor people in all countries. There are a lot more poor people in some countries, but we should disabuse ourselves of the notions that it's just about browbeating one set of countries into coughing up more money and the problem will be solved.
Mm-hmm.
You need to address justice and equity and distributional related challenges in all of these countries. If we just hand millions and millions of dollars to a lot of governments right now, as a lot of civil society activists in those countries will tell you, empowering and enriching a lot of their governments is not necessarily the best solution to climate.
Yeah.
More generally, I'm sorry, what was the rest of your question?
So I was wondering, like, in this specific case where some countries need the economic growth than
Africa,
like,
and leapfrog. Yeah. So it's happened in some areas, right? No one is suggesting anymore that a lot of developing countries in Africa build centrally planned phone lines to give everyone landlines in their homes. Mm-hmm. It's outmoded technology. You don't need it. It's incredibly expensive. We will never get phones to anyone. A lot of people in Africa have access to cell phones. That is a distributed technology. It is not a hub and spoke system. You don't have to have a wire attached to your cell phone to get cell phone service.
Sure.
By the same token, a lot of regions of Africa, as I understand it, and this varies widely again, would be ill-suited to our, you know, basically centralized baseload method of electricity distribution. You build a big coal plant, you build transmission lines, you build distribution in the regions. It's incredibly cost intensive. If you can have distributed solar, distributed geothermal, localized wind, you will provide the same benefits at a lower cost with fewer health impacts to the same people. So, yes, the question is, why would you take a 19th century approach to energy development in the 21st century if there are 21st century solutions available? I don't think anyone is going to seriously say, like, we should follow what the UK did in the 1890s to power our grid now. You can, but there's just better choices available.
So the Inflation Reduction Act, we've touched on it a little bit. It is a large piece of legislation that has grabbed a lot of attention in the climate space in 2022, but it is not the important, or not the only important thing that happened in this space. Mm-hmm. There were other commitments that were made in this space, including the Kigali Amendment. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, one thing that we hear a lot from listeners and folks who don't live in this space is you only see what the headlines tell mm-hmm. you is happening. So we were hoping maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit more about that mm-hmm. amendment and perhaps some other incredible moves in the climate space that happened in 2022 that they might not have seen.
Yeah, so it's a great question. The Kigali Amendment is a wonderful success story. It's most people have not heard of it because it is incredibly successful and non-controversial, which I wish all international and environment agreements could, we could say the same about them. It's basically a treaty framework from the late 80s in the Reagan era and the Thatcher era. There was a discovery that the production of ozone, ozone-depleting chemicals, fluorocarbons, basically industrial propellants used in foam sealing and refrigeration and cooling, lots of industrial applications, when emitted into the air, were basically eating away at the ozone layer, which basically protects us from harmful radiation from the sun. If we didn't do anything about it, you know, all these doomsday scenarios, the polar ice caps would melt, and we'd get cancer, but basically what the terrible movie Waterworld depicted. So this was an agreement basically to avoid that, to transition the world away from these incredibly important but relatively obscure set of industrial chemicals. It turned out over time that both those original sets of chemicals, but the ones that we replace those ozone depleting chemicals with, also have really high global warming potential. So even though they don't deplete the ozone layer, they warm the climate really fast, much faster than carbon dioxide. So you needed to do something about that to bring them down as well. The Kigali Amendment, which was struck in 2016 during the Obama administration with a whole bunch of other countries in the world in Kigali, Rwanda, was basically an agreement to do that, to take this most recent set of chemicals. They're called hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, doesn't matter what they're called. They warm the climate. You want less of them. To provide a system to step down the production and use of those over time. Not phase them out, but phase them down. It's a success story because the reason the Senate approved it is not because everyone who voted for it in the Senate is a climate champion, it's because it made evident economic sense.
Right.
The people driving this were the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, big business lobbies, because the United States is poised to be a huge winner in this global transition. We have innovated and produced a lot of the chemicals that the world needs to turn to in this transition. And the United States was also behind the formulation of the original agreement. We provide a lot of money to help other countries transition and accomplish this. And so the reason I don't think anyone heard about it, because it was a conscious communication strategy, right? Going out and yelling about the climate benefits of this agreement, frankly, would drown out the significant economic benefits it provides to the economy. And that's economic benefits, but I see economics. Bad phrasing. We wanted the business case to lead here. We basically wanted people to look at this as an innovation and export-driven agreement the Senate should push. You know, it took a while. This didn't happen until September of last year. The administration sent it up many, many months before that. But it's a really wonderful success story because it was bipartisan. You know, everyone from Mitch McConnell to Ed Markey voted for this thing. There's a lot of senators that came together to do this in the end because they saw that there was no reason not to do this. In fact, if you want to make the argument that a lot of senators made, People's Republic of China is a party to this agreement. They are at the table writing the rules of the road. Do you think we are better served by not being at that table or being at that table? There's an economic competitive argument to make here that has nothing to do with climate. I think that's what we try and do with climate a lot of the times. The IRA, to take a key example, let's say you care nothing about climate change. It just doesn't move you. the human health improvements that will result from the Inflation Reduction Act will more than pay for the entire cost of the Inflation Reduction Act, just on the basis of avoided hospital trips and heart disease and COPD. The Inflation Reduction Act saves America money, setting aside the economic benefits. And so you want a message to different audiences, because I think people in my movement sometimes think the solution is to just be louder than we are about climate, and being louder doesn't necessarily convince people.
You definitely piqued Shada's interest here. I see her Googling Kigali Amendment. I'm the reporter in you is like already on this.
Yeah, I was trying to see like which senators actually were involved, like Senator Menendez as well. So
yeah.
So Kigali Agreement, it was a legally binding agreement, right? I guess my question is that apart from the economic aspect that you have to sell, is having a legally binding agreement helpful?
You mean internationally legally binding, like legally binding targets?
Yeah.
So it's one of those things, it's like an international carbon price, right?
Yeah.
In theory, yes. Just can't get there. We tried it. It's called the Kyoto Protocol. It did not work. It did not have, at the time, the world's largest emitter at the table. It did not have the Chinese government at the table. It did not have the Indian government at the table. There was no sense that most countries were going to agree to an international framework where everyone set targets and they were legally binding at the international level and they would face sanction if they didn't meet them. You would have had an insufficient participation in that agreement. I mean, over time, Canada withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol. I think Australia withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol. That's clearly not a model for success if you have an insufficiently ambitious agreement that countries feel they can leave and not meet their targets. It was very clear, and a lot of my colleagues are much more experienced this than I am, in the years leading up to Paris, you had to find a different way. Trying to recreate the Kyoto framework would probably just result in the same problem as the Kyoto framework. Also, in the many years since Kyoto, you had People's Republic of China and a lot of other developing economies become, if not the largest, some of the largest emitters in the world. Kyoto was basically a totally bifurcated agreement. All the requirements were on developed countries. Everything for developing countries was voluntary. That's why the Senate rejected it. So we basically had to have a new model, and that's why the bottom-up process of Paris basically eliminates, for the moment being, the developed versus developing country dichotomy. It's what can you do within your existing abilities, and how long will it take you to meet you and if meet those? And if you're going to have trouble, the international community will step in and help you. I don't think internationally legally binding treaties of that type were seriously considered, just because it was clear you wouldn't have... The United States wouldn't be able to join. It's unlikely the Chinese government would be able to join. And then you're back to square one. If you don't have the two largest emitters at the table and a lot of other countries, you haven't really solved the problem. So I think a lot of people hit on internationally legally binding as the central flaw of the Paris Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a feature that ever would have been possible with the Paris Agreement. The Kigali Amendment is a vastly different thing. It deals with a very discrete set of industrial gases in a couple specific segments of every country's economy. They are not central to everything we do. Whereas the Paris Agreement deals with all kinds of carbon emissions in all parts of the economy in really differing circumstances in lots of parts of the world. So I don't know if that makes any sense.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. So basically we have the other end of the spectrum, which is the Kyoto Protocol, and we've got the Paris Agreement.
Yeah.
So what's next? Like, what's the next agreement? What does it look like?
So I think what we're trying to get out of the habit of is thinking that this problem needs to be solved with more big, flashy international diplomatic agreements. If Paris works, you should never need another Paris, because it changes over time. It should be able to adapt to new national circumstances and new technologies. As I said, it's a 5-year ratchet system. So if we have any chance of beating this challenge, it's not going to be like, oh, scrapping the Paris Agreement and taking another 25 years to do the next Paris Agreement. It's investing in the existing framework. Okay. And that's why, if I had a dime for every member of Congress who sent someone a letter at some point saying we need to tear up the Paris Agreement and renegotiate it so it just sanctions China, as if you can have an international agreement that just punishes one country. We have the framework. We need to make it work.
Yeah.
There's the Kigali Amendment. There's the International Maritime Organization. There's the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO. All of these multilateral bodies are dealing with climate in their sectors. Mm-hmm. So I think we have the structures. There are other things that are sort of on the margins of climate, like the Convention on Biological Diversity, which the U.S. is not a party of, but we participated in last year. There could be a new marine plastics agreement. These are sort of climate adjacent, but they're not actually about climate emissions. I think in terms of the multilateral tools, We have the funds, the Green Climate Fund, the Adaptation Fund, we have the agreements, the Paris Agreement. They're all there. It's making the architecture work. It's making the system function. And so I don't think it's actually a question of what is the next big agreement. It's can we make the existing set of agreements work better?
How would you make it work better?
Well, the basic problem is, you know, it's domestic political will in a lot of these countries. I cannot sit here and control who the people of Brazil or India or Indonesia put in office, much less can I control the governments of countries that are not functional democracies, that are essentially autocracies.
Yeah.
You need partners in those countries. As we were talking about earlier, you can't force countries to do things they don't want to. And so we are thrilled that there is a government now in Brazil that takes deforestation really seriously. We are thrilled that there's a new government in Australia that takes curbing climate emissions seriously. But you have to deal with the hand you're dealt. Some countries are going to be more resistant to this than others, and so you focus on the ones that actually want to come to the dance. But that's the central thing we need more of, is political will in countries that aren't quite ready yet to make the commitments and deploy the capital we think they should.
And would you see the role of the United States in that future of policymaking?
I think we want to both lead by example in terms of what we're doing at home, and we want to facilitate as much progress overseas as we can, providing finance and technical assistance and diplomatic leadership. We want to be someone who is not trying to pressure other countries to do this stuff, but making the path clear and providing them all the tools to get there. It's not a question of guilting or shaming other countries. I think it's making all of the available resources we've talked about throughout this conversation available to them. I hope the U.S. doesn't stray from this path we have in the past, but trying to make it basically politically difficult for the United States to do anything else, I think, is what people and people like me try and do.
I have a closing question for you. You're super eloquent. You know these issues super well. You've been working in this space for a long time, and yet in the middle of it all, you went to go to grad school. So what prompted that decision to go to SAIS? Like, what did you not have in your career that you felt like you needed secondary education to help you get? How did it help you advance in your career now?
It's a great question. So I had several friends who did this, who work in my field during the Trump years. I started in domestic environmental policy. I sort of fell backwards accidentally into international environmental policy. Environmental policy and activism, when I worked on it, was not quite as credentialed field. Unless you're a technical expert and you're doing something very scientific, you don't always need a grad degree to do that kind of work on the Hill and places that I worked on. And foreign policy, as you all know better than I do, is a pretty credentialed field. Most people working in this field have master's degrees.
Yeah.
They want to be able to point out that they have a basic core foundational understanding of international policy. I didn't have that. And while I think I'd done pretty well without one, I was worried that it would be a limit to future progress in my career. There are also just some things that you don't ever absorb unless someone forces you to learn about them. You know, monetary policy, international trade, a lot of economic history. I just wasn't going to get via osmosis in my jobs unless I was like beaten with a stick. That's not what my education was. Unless I was had a great group of professors and colleagues who were willing to do that journey with me. I made the choice to do it part-time. So I did one of SAIS's part-time mid-career programs, which was great and basically allowed me to keep working full-time. But I had friends who did the full-time route, who left their jobs, went and focused fully on grad school, and there's no right way to do it. But I really enjoyed it. And the great thing about the mid-career programs, I should say, here at SAIS, is that you get people like yourselves from all parts of the world and industries. We had military, we had foreign diplomats, we had folks working in the sciences, financial services, development policy. So you learn as much from your colleagues as you do from the professors. It's a wonderful environment that, had I just signed up for a correspondence course and did it all by myself, I don't think it would have been nearly as enriching. So I'm glad I did it. It was exhausting.
Yeah.
Like working full-time and going to grad school is not something I recommend if you want to, like, sleep a lot.
Yeah. Retroactively give me that advice. Yeah.
It's too late for everyone here in this room.
Seriously. I love that you did it in the transition between administrations, mm-hmm. where I can't speak for you guys, but one of the reasons I decided to do this degree, and ours is focused on specifically sustainable energy, because I was like, the train is now leaving the station. Like, this is actually going to happen in the United States. There's going to be a lot of demand for professionals who know this stuff.
Totally.
And so it's been really rewarding to see the work that you're doing kind of play out while learning. And then I have to agree with you too, the aha moments as a mid-career person, early mid-career person, I should say,
in learning about the context that these policies have been created and the economic relationships that have created the dynamics that we're watching, it's been so much like, oh, that's why that's the way it is. And like, oh, this is what Kyoto was. Mm-hmm. Like, it's been very helpful in terms of like bolstering my ability mm-hmm. to engage in this space in a way that I didn't, you know, I thought I was going to be fine without a secondary degree, but it's been very helpful.
Totally. Absolutely agree.
Thanks, Jesse. I'm going to jump into our dumb question in this episode, which is traveling bad for environment? In the age of global warming, we should care about the impact on environment from our decision and lifestyle. So the answer for the dumb question is unfortunately yes. Every vacation has a direct impact on the environment. So during pandemic, we had a limitation on travels and other economic activities. So emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases plunged by 4.6% in 2020. According to the World Travel and Tourism Council, 8 to 10% of global CO2 emissions are caused by the travel and tourism sectors. But majority of such emissions are caused by travel to and from a destination. Especially air travel has a potent climate impact since aircraft emissions are released high in the atmosphere. So what is the alternatives? Generally, trains and coaches are the lowest carbon means of travel, much lower than flying and cars. The US lacks high-speed trains and has less rail infrastructure in general than Europe or other Asian countries, combined with a large distance between its cities. But it also has a growing political movement to build high-speed train lines as a part of the Green New Deals. For air travelers, first and foremost, you could attempt a flight diet, like cutting half the number of flights. But while reducing the number of flights you take, there are some effective ways of cutting your aviation footprint. So first of all, you should know how much carbon footprint you could emit on your trip. So Google Flights shows estimate carbon emissions in the search result. Also, booking with airlines that are using biofuel is a great idea. In 2016, United Airlines started using sustainable aviation biofuel in all their planes out of Los Angeles. And a longer flight is more efficient than a shorter flight or with multiple layovers. A quarter of airplanes' emissions came from landing and taking off. And also, before you try to update your seat, you should know that the footprint per passenger per distance traveled is 3 times greater for business or first class than for economy class, since floor space on a given airplane. So lastly, you can offset your emissions by donating money to development of clean energy alternatives. But offsetting emissions and avoiding emissions are two different actions, but there are those carbon offset schemes that most airlines offer these days in their booking procedures. Anyway, so I provided enough information. Before you book your flight this summer, try to think again about whether it's possible to do something similar that just doesn't involve the flight, or consider alternative transportation. I hope you enjoy your sustainable travel. Thank you.
Thanks, Leonie. That's a wrap for today's episode of the Hopkins Green Tea. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with Jesse Young and gained valuable insights into climate governance. Before we sign off, we want to extend our gratitude to Jesse for joining us today and sharing his expertise.
Thanks for having me.
Now, if you are interested in more climate change and energy-related content, make sure to follow us on Twitter by searching for our handle at Hopkins Green Tea, all in one word. We're also on LinkedIn. Just search for our name, Hopkins Green Tea, and connect with us. This episode can be found on both Spotify and Apple Podcasts. So make sure to subscribe and leave us a review. We value your feedback and would love to hear what topics you'd like us to explore in future episodes. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.